Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Cinemas podcast. This week we are discussing Amarasanti's United Kingdom. I'm Sam Howlett and this week I'm joined by Jake Cunningham.
Hello.
And Harry Chapman.
Hello.
So United Kingdom tells the true story of Botswanan Prince Seretse Khama and London local Ruth Williams and their controversial interracial marriage. It's a true story that we all feel like we really should have known before we went into the film, and that it's a historical event that should be more famous. So my opening question for you guys is, which historical event that hasn't been made into a film should be made into a film that more people should know about? Jake?
Yep. So we all know that there's a Jamie Vardy film coming out. Yeah.
He's having a party.
Exactly. Yep. Jamie Vardy's having a party. So Jamie Vardy scored, he's got the record for most number of consecutive goals scored in games in the Premier League. Brought Leicester to their title-winning season. But for me, Jamie Vardy is not what made Leicester last year. I think there are a lot of players that took part in that title-winning scene, so I want to see the Leicester City film, because it's not just about Jamie Vardy's party, is it? You know, there's Riyad Mahrez, there's N'Golo Kanté. And, I mean, it's heartbreak. Like, Kanté, he comes in, he's the rock that holds the team together. He's that binding agent. And then at the end of the season, what does he do? A big money deal to Chelsea. What? Has he sold his soul? Or is it going to be like Harry and the Hendersons? And Jamie Vardy and Riyad Mahrez are looking at N'Golo Kanté and...
Like, get out of here!
Yeah, exactly.
But no one wants you here. But they, goodbye, my friend.
Exactly. And they know that it's probably going to be better for him, because Leicester
can't
do it
again. Going to be tough to be kind.
Exactly. Mm. And so, and you've got other classic characters like Danny Drinkwater, Robert Huth... Just family names that everyone knows and loves.
Christian Fuchs.
Exactly. I mean,
who would play Kanté in your film?
I would like him to play him. I mean, he's got.
Right.
He can't do that.
He's got so much charisma on the field.
If he brings tenth of that to the screen,
yeah.
Would it be like Escape to Victory, where you just have like you have like certain stars, and then the Tottenham team of that year?
Yeah. And I think, no, we'll just film most of it in wide shots, so you can't really tell who's playing him. And then we'll just film close-ups on a green screen, and then just cut them in whenever we need them.
This sounds like it will work.
Yeah, I can only see this working.
Nice, nice.
Yeah. We can call it Dilly Ding Dilly Dong.
Get the pieces in.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a historical event, which, I mean, it clearly needs that adaptation, doesn't it? I think we've all agreed.
Yeah, interesting. Jake choosing one from recent history. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a historical event that no one knows about, seeing as it happened 12 months ago.
Maybe 5 months ago.
Yeah. Interesting choice all the same.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Harry Chapman.
So recently there's been a lot of disruption around the Freddie Mercury film.
Yes.
Have we all heard this?
Yes. The guy from Mr. Robot?
Yeah,
he's
due to be in it.
Yeah.
And the reason Sacha Baron Cohen didn't want to do it was because apparently the rest of the Queen members said, like, halfway through the film, Freddie dies, and then it's how Queen is rebuilt during that. I just want to see that. I just want to see post-Freddie,
okay,
the Queen story, how they get back to doing New Year's Eve 2015. We all remember that, don't we?
Yeah,
we all watched
that,
it.
Yeah.
We watched it.
With Adam someone from...
American Idol.
Yeah,
Adam Levine.
No.
No. But obviously it's the Queen frontman we know and love.
I just think it would be funny if they produced it themselves.
And like, acted in it themselves.
Yeah, and acted in it themselves. Like, dyed their Brian Mayer dyeing his hair. It'd be great, wouldn't it? Yeah. It's a film no
I can
one
only
wants to
see that being yeah. great. Yeah.
I think they were against the Sacha Baron Cohen biopic because it was going to be too adult and go a bit too R-rated. And they were like, no, we want to keep it clean. We want it to be a family film.
There's no drama there.
Exactly. Yeah.
We like biopics because they actually give us some conflict about these people.
And the point is that they're flawed characters having a biopic.
Yeah, we don't want happy, good times.
And it's going to be directed by Bryan Singer.
We will see.
We'll see. My choice would be Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who I remember from GCSE history. And this was during the Cold War and the Red Scare in America. There are this couple who played a small part in selling secrets to the Soviets about the A-bomb, but they played a very minor part, but they were the ones that were caught for it and publicly executed.
Wow.
But it was a huge media storm, loads of people protesting it, and I think it kind of marked a change in America during the Cold War where the people finally realised how this was absolutely an insane part of their history.
What grade did you get?
I believe I got a B.
Nice.
Thank you.
Good.
You still remember it, so learning's learning.
But no, I think this is an untapped piece of history that could be really interesting to film.
Yeah.
Nice.
I think that could be like definitely down the Bridge of Spies
feel. Definitely.
Which I actually really want to rewatch.
I really enjoyed Bridge of Spies.
I haven't seen it.
Mate, come on. Steven Spielberg's best film.
back to the task at hand. So this is what we were discussing at United Kingdom. But before we get into it, Jake, you interviewed director Amarasanti a few weeks ago, didn't you?
I did. So this was just on the eve of a United Kingdom opening the London Film Festival. And I spoke to her about the film, her previous film, Belle, and being a female director in the film industry today and how that's changed in sort of the 15 years of her career as well, and also how stylish David Oyelowo is. So lots of important points and then one that's maybe even more important.
Alright, so here's that interview. This is Jake Cunningham interviewing Amarasanti.
So we are delighted to welcome Amarasanti, director of A United Kingdom, onto the Curzon podcast this week. How are you doing today?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well,
good.
Thank you. United Kingdom, I'd like to begin by asking you about the women at the centre of the racial conflict that we see in United Kingdom and your previous film, Belle. Mm. One's upper class, the other a typist, neither a stereotypical radical. What was it that drew you to these characters?
I mean, the woman's voice in cinema, in stories, both emotionally and her literal vocal voice, are very important for me. And I think oftentimes when we're dealing with stories that are about race, it's really easy to negate class. And what's really interesting about Lady Canning, who I guess is one of the women that you're talking about, the upper class woman, who is the wife of an empire mogul, can I call him? We forget that actually, though Rosamund Pike's character, Ruth, her interaction is mainly with this woman in Africa. In England, they wouldn't have really mixed. In London, they would have been of different classes. They wouldn't have intermingled. There would have been a class issue between them. And so I wanted to, without banging anybody on the head with a kind of hammer about it, sort of really subtly dance around the class issues as well as issues of race in this story. And generally, there are the two white women that you're talking about, but there's also the black female perspective as well in the story, which comes from the African women who are responding to Rosamund Pike's character coming in and, expecting to become their queen. And so it was making sure that all sides, all facets of female reaction are kind of covered in the story, really, whilst politics at the time was really a man's domain.
Mm.
And
I think you play with that expectation of what we're coming to see throughout the United Kingdom. When we find out he's a king, we kind of expect a very regal residence when we go over there.
Yes.
And we find something completely different with a tin roof.
Yes, absolutely. Which was the real house that Ruth and Soretse lived in when Soretse took Ruth to Africa to be his queen. We put that house lovingly back together. But the interesting thing was that it was considered absolutely and completely a luxurious house at the time, because when you look at how everybody else is living, and it's not terrible, it's not bad, but, you know, the traditional house to live in at the time was a rondavel, which is a village sort of, it's a round hut that they live in. And this house is a sort of palace compared to that. But we wanted to stay true to that. Truth is, when they arrived, they didn't have running water. There were all sorts of... There's a whole world that she had to get used to, you know, in many ways, that is not the same as living in Blackheath in London.
And at the centre of both films, the United Kingdom and Belle is a love story. And you use that to access the political story. Is that something that you just find for audiences, what makes accessing the political side of the story a bit more easy by centering it around the love story in the first place?
Well, I am a massive romantic. That's the truth. And as a filmmaker and as a viewer as well, an audience member, there are, you know, I am sort of multifaceted. I'm really interested in politics, but I'm also really moved by deep love stories. Whenever I think about loss and death, the thing that always strikes me most is how it feels for a couple who have been together for 50 years, 60 years. It's maybe one thing to lose a father, but when you think about those people who married during the war and stayed together for 50 or 60 years, know no other life really other than that with their partner, and then suddenly one dies. And so I'm naturally drawn to romantic relationships and the nature of that and what allows them to sustain and how strong they can be, how far you can pull them before they have to pop, if that makes sense. I'm interested in that, but I'm also interested in politics, and I think ultimately politics affects love in some ways. It shouldn't, we don't want it to, but the two can sometimes get in the way of each other, as you saw with Belle. He had to make, okay, a legal decision, which would also have political implications. But his love for her leaves us with the question, was he that man in the first place, and that's why he took in a child that was racially different to him? Or did his love for that child make him into the person he became, who made the decision that he ended up making on behalf of slaves and for the protection of slaves? So I find that fascinating. And what you get with the love story, you see, is the intimate. And what you get with the political story is the world and the big, fat, wider world. And I love the two together. I love bouncing between those two things.
And you can reflect the outside world within that relationship
absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely.
Clearly see throughout.
Yeah, absolutely. And it allows me to really get under the skin of how big world politics affects us as individuals, you know. And in my first film, it wasn't a love story, but it was looking at how big world politics affects, you know, white kids growing up in South Wales who have been excluded from society. They are underclass children who are not allowed to partake in mainstream society, and through their individual small relationships, you see how bigger politics can affect the individual. So the nation, the individual, the politics versus the individual, I'm always fascinated with that.
Excellent. And going back to your first film, A Way of Life, it came out 12 years ago now.
Yeah.
I was wondering how the landscape for yourself as a female director has changed in that time.
Well, it didn't feel to me as if anybody was talking about it back then. But that might be my perception as opposed to reality. And I think for me, what's made a big difference is social media and the fact that social media can galvanise opinions. I can have a conversation with a woman in Atlanta over the issue of, diversity within business, or be talking to another film director about it, you know, in China, for instance. And so social media has galvanised, and what galvanising does is motivate as well in some ways and agitates in a great way. So I think that its very existence has made my journey slightly easier. It wasn't something I could really concentrate too much on at the time, because if you thought about the obstacles, you thought about the statistics, you thought about the numbers, you just wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. It was just all too big and too difficult. And all I really wanted to do, again, the bigger politics, the bigger structure that you exist in, and the intimate story here was that I just wanted to tell my stories. I just had stories that I wanted to get out of me and put down on paper and then hopefully one day put up on screen. And so one just puts one foot in front of the other every day and carries on writing and ploughs away. And in the meantime, things have changed, and that's great.
David Oyelowo, who plays Siretse Kama in the film, he said that he felt pushed out of the UK because of the glass ceiling, and it was only after his career picked up in America that he was offered roles in UK film.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think needs to change for black people starting off in the film industry in the UK to feel more at home?
Well, first of all, I think it has to start with the stories and the financiers, the people who are commissioning and allowing those stories to be told. In the sense that we've become very, very, very used to a default existence on screen. We've been told that for years that what films are stories about a particular kind of person in a particular kind of age group and a particular gender. And that's for all of us. That's for black people, white people, women and men. We've all come to see that as what a normal film is in many ways. And whenever we see anything outside of that, It may throw you slightly, or is that a real film, or is it a bit art house? Or, you know, we have all sorts of words and language for anything that comes out of the default experience. And you have to think about this. If most 90% of films that you saw on screen were about black females born in Streatham, it would be weird. And if they were all made by black females also born in Streatham, it would be weird. And yet, in a weird way, we sort of have our own, of course I'm being facetious, but we have our own weird version of this going on at the moment. And so first of all, we have to learn to see diversity as not a word, you know, films that fit within that remit as normal. It's okay. They're also default. My experience is as default as yours is. That's the first thing. And my gaze is as default as yours is. We're the same but different, and that's what's interesting for audiences. So I'm not at all advocating to get rid of the default experience that we've seen on screen, but to add other experiences to that as well. And then the second thing is that we have to learn to not, when we do have them, not see them as different and uncomfortable. Once we get to that point, then characters can be written for people like David to play and Idris to play, as Idris does, you know, brilliantly, and David does brilliantly, and for Chiwetel to play, and for all the female, wonderful female actresses of colour that we have to play, and it will not be seen as different, art house, ethnic, diverse, you know, all of those weird names that we have to give it, because if they're anything outside of the default experience, they have a funny thing attached to them. They have a funny label attached to them. I think that's the key, and I think we're not there yet in Britain. You know, I think it's something that critics have to look at. It's something that financiers have to look at. It's something that we as writers have to take, you know, be wary of all of the time, to ensure that we understand that the world is bigger than the default experience. And make other experiences the default experience.
Now, there's a line in the film, I think it's between Siretse and his uncle. He says that they have had to stay apart to stay at peace.
Yes.
Do you think ultimately if people are to come together, whether that's in what we call a default film experience or anything really, that there will always be conflict before that point?
Well, I think that when that line comes, it's part of Siretse's journey. It's the point where Siretse hasn't, what I like to do is ensure that who the character is at the beginning is not necessarily who they are at the end, but that you have a footprint of who they're going to be. So you see, you get the line at the very beginning of the film when he's talking to Ruth. He says, still, we need to do more in terms of their country to be masters of our own fate. And he then repeats that later on, and it's in a whole different context, and he's talking to his people. And that's the completion of his journey at that point, for our film's sake. And I think at the point where he says we need to stay apart at peace, he's in the middle of that journey and he's still learning. Maybe it doesn't have to be that way. You know, what I'm constantly dealing with in characters is conditioning versus instinct. I think for me, our character of Siretse's instinct is about togetherness, but his conditioning has been about separation. He was born into a country which didn't necessarily have apartheid, but the rules for whites were different to those for blacks. And so there's, to me, that's part of a learning process, a learning curve that is interesting to me to put characters through, so that by the time he comes to the end of the film, it's not about being apart, it's about being together in many ways.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll go slightly less serious now.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about David Oyelowo wearing a hat. He wears a hat incredibly well.
He wears a hat incredibly well, and I have to tell you that my favourite hat was his grey hat. He wore his black hat a lot, and he had a brown hat too. But I always said, David, you're most dashing to me when you're in your grey hat. So he had his grey hat in London quite often, and he does wear it well. I mean, David's a fashion horse. You must know that.
He does look incredible throughout the film.
Yes, he does. And I remember saying to my husband, darling, three-piece suits. This is the new thing. We're going to have to get you into some three-piece here, because it looks amazing. It makes every man look fantastic.
Excellent. Well, Amaro Sante, thanks a lot for joining
Thank
us on the Curzon Podcast.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank Bye-bye. You.
Okay. Amaro Sante there. So you talked there about how there's kind of this thing about the film being a romance film and using the romance to tell the story of a race film.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because I remember I went to the press conference of this after it screened in the London Film Festival, and someone asked a similar question to Rosamund Pike, and she responded with something along the lines of, it's a romance film, but because people are so hung up on race, it's being sold in the same vein as 12 Years a Slave and films like that. So she kind of hinted that it's the racial implications are overshadowing the fact that at its heart, this is.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The love story. So what do you guys think of this? Do you see it as a race film or as a romance film? Obviously, it can be both. But
I think she's almost talking like that's what the end goal is. Like in our best selves, that's what we should see it as.
Yes.
Like we should just be seeing this as a romance. But because of the society we live in now, there is no other way of seeing it but as also a race film as well.
Yeah, it's still so relevant today, isn't it? It's shocking how relevant that, you know, with things like alt-right being in the news recently and, you know, things like that, it still feels so pertinent when you watch it.
Yeah, and the kind of governmental dealings all feel like it's very under the table, and it does make you worry about what's going on now.
Yeah, all I would say about the government side of the film is I think Amaro Sante is incredibly even-handed with it. So you have in the film, you have Clement Attlee not going against it, but then you also have Churchill going against his word, and it's really even-handed that it goes from both sides of the aisle.
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
It's not just attacking the right.
Tories evil, Labour good.
Yeah, exactly.
Could have easily done that. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's a historical film, but I think the way they present it, you're right.
Yeah.
They're all in it for themselves in a way, and they're not really thinking about it in terms of as the couple. They're thinking of it as a national scandal.
Yeah, I think in terms of the story, I actually think that it's been marketed as a romance film or romantic film, But in fact, when you watch it, it's a lot more political. It's a very much a political film. It gets through the romance bit really quickly, and then you get into this sort of politics.
And I think that's something clever that she does. And she did that on Belle as well.
Yeah.
And you use the romance to get people in.
Yes.
And you get them engaged, and it makes the story accessible. And then that's where you can very gradually feed them into the bigger picture.
Yeah, and so people don't really realise they're watching a political film. They think they're just watching a romance film.
Yeah, definitely. So maybe we should just give a bit more context to the actual story. Ruth Williams meets Sarezi Karma in London. They start courting, and eventually she realises that he is the Prince of Bechuana Land, which is now called Botswana. And the romance blooms from there, but obviously it's not the 1950s.
40s when it starts.
Okay, 1940s, so there is still a large amount of prejudice against an interracial couple from both sides, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just angry white people. There's also tension back home.
Yeah. Well, and even within the black community in London, that there's a particular moment which was really lovely of Ruth and Sarezi playing snooker, and she pots something.
The black. To win.
Yeah, and you just see, and she like screams because she's happy or something, and you can just see the whole Sarezi's club that they're in just glaring at her as well. But I really think that was something clever throughout that film of the contrast between who can be racist, really.
Yeah. It's not just, you know, it's not like she gets there and the country accepts her.
The country is in love with her.
And it's just white Britain that rejects
definitely.
Her. So I think it's really even-handed.
Mm. And I like how hard life is for her over there. And they really, they push that, I think, quite a lot.
Mm.
Yeah.
Rightly so, that it's not this easy transition that she just goes over there and it's okay because she's with the man she loves. It's really horrible.
Yeah.
That she's treated really unkindly, and then when she has the child, it's quite a distressing few scenes there. And I thought she acted amazingly.
Yeah, in those scenes. I think she really gets across what it's like having probably never been abroad.
Yeah.
In the 40s to then suddenly being dropped in this desert hot land.
And in the 40s a working class girl from London will have no idea what Bechuana Land is like.
Exactly.
And Rosamund Pike said on another film podcast.
there are others.
I know, there are other ones. She said on another one that her going over there, she suddenly knew that she was royalty, but being from 1940s Britain, the only image of royalty she had was from her own queen, Princess Margaret. And so she went over there and dressed as she had known royalty to dress, and this is like 45 degrees, 50 degrees, and she's there in white gloves and stockings.
Yeah,
just because that's the only image she has.
There's a lovely scene where she looks at a photograph of the Queen and she tries to do her wave.
Yes.
And then she tries to do it later on and like clearly looks around and is like, I look ridiculous. That, like no one wants to see that.
So we talked a bit there about Rosamund Pike, but for me this is David Oyelowo's film, and I think he has really marked himself as one of the best British actors at the moment.
He's really great,
absolutely astounding. I mean, from Selma he was robbed, not even nominated for an Oscar, and then to just push through, and I think he's really become the forefront of a black British actor, and this is a perfect film to showcase that, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting, we mentioned about him not getting work in the UK until he got work in America. And we always think of America as this divided, like highly exaggerated platform for racial conflict.
Mm.
And now that just makes me feel even worse for us if we're not willing to give people work.
Exactly. Well, I think a lot of black British actors, like Idris Elba, had to get his start in America when he was on The Wire.
Mm.
I think it happens quite a lot.
Yeah, it does. They have to go over there and then come back.
Yeah, roles for black English actors are probably, they're quite slim. And so Oyelowo has taken it upon himself to kind of talk about that, which I think is really good.
Yeah.
It would also be, I feel like now he's set up a platform that hopefully David Oyelowo can do films that aren't just about race necessarily.
Yes.
They're sort of big topics, but it was nice for him to be in a big budget film that just had him as the main character and maybe didn't mention race.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sort of going back to Rosamund Pike's.
Yeah, that's the point I want to get to.
Yeah,
absolutely. Another really interesting point I got from the press conference that I went to was that someone asked, how did the... Because they filmed on location in Botswana.
Okay.
And someone asked, how did the Botswana locals feel about English people making this film? And Amarasanthi said, well, they were... She says she's not sure exactly, but she knows that they were pleased that it was being made by a black woman. Do you think that's important for the narrative of the film to know that it's made by a black woman?
You know, I don't know. I think it's... I don't know how important it is for the narrative of the film, but I think it's important for the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important that black stories being told by black directors.
Yes.
Well, we got Fences coming up. Fences soon looks, with Denzel Washington.
Which Moonlight was, as well.
Yeah.
Really excited for those two. Yeah.
I think ultimately Amarasanthi is a really great director.
Yeah.
And I think because she's so good at making stories where you think you're watching one thing and actually you're watching another.
Yeah.
I think that's why it was important that she directed it. I'm not sure her race necessarily affects the making of the film.
Yeah, but I think if you just said that the people of Botswana said that they felt that was important, whether then that gives her more accessibility.
Oh yeah.
To like well the people and the location.
I think maybe could be the case.
Yeah. And that allows her and the crew to get more personal and create a more intimate film if they have that relationship with the area that they're filming in.
Because I think there is, on one hand this is a film about race, but there's also a film about empire as well. We haven't really talked about that much.
Very much so.
And this, I got the journalist to ask, I can't remember who it was, what publication they were from, but it was something I hadn't really thought about, this idea of probably a predominantly white production, English, going into Africa to make this film that is equally a story of Botswana and a story of England. But no, I think they got around that very well, from what she said.
I think Empire is so, just quickly, I think Empire is so crucial to this whole film. And there's a line, I think it might be the first line, or it's very close to the beginning, where Nicholas Lyndhurst, who plays the dad, on the radio, it says about India's independence. And he says, good luck getting on without us. and I think instantly you know where you are. You know that the British Empire is sort of crumbling at this point and sort of reducing
its
size.
This is the end.
And it's interesting that the film is basically about trying to keep hold of certain parts of the empire and keep relationships with the Commonwealth.
Well, I think you see that with Jack Davenport's character in his hat when he turns up in Botswana with this old style empire.
Oh, yes.
Like a giant cockatiel on his head.
Yeah.
I was going to talk just then about the supporting actors and supporting characters, and I think Jack Davenport, he does what Jack Davenport's done a few times before.
Just a weasel.
Smarmy, English villain. Very old-fashioned.
He does it so well.
Yeah. But I think he tones it down from what he did in Pirates of the Caribbean, for example. Because he felt like a real person.
Yeah.
Yes.
He felt like he
just
was...
following orders.
Following orders, exactly. I felt like he was a typical sort of politician of the time when he was trying to sell something to Ruth and Soretzi rather than just completely screw them over,
I think that's true. He very much feels like a smarmy car salesman.
Yeah, definitely. He's like, no guys, this is the best deal I can get you, don't worry, I'm going to sort everything out for you.
It's
interesting. I still think his character is so relevant today in terms of what goes on behind the officials that are elected. Like, there are people that are sort of put in these positions and still given these sort of roles. You know, in the news recently there's been whether the UK are going to have an ambassador to the US. And that's been really in the news. And actually this whole, should we vote for things, should we not, the democracy of things.
Yeah.
And the fact he's a sir as well is so crucial to that kind of old empire feeling around the whole thing.
Absolutely. And we've got Tom Felton in it. Is it Fenton or Felton?
Felton.
Felton.
Fenton.
Fenton!
And who was in Belle as well.
Yeah, he's I think he's a lovely little actor. I think it's a very different role for him from Harry Potter, from Draco Malfoy. And I think it because it kind of has that evilness of Draco, but it's a lot more grown up, and it's a lot more, I think he has a lot more control over the character and all his lines because of the character. And this is the same in Bell, I think. He has a lot more control over his lines and what he calculates everything, and I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think you see at the end of the Harry Potter films how Draco is really not himself.
Yeah.
Anyway, like that persona, it really shaves away as you go through those films. And I think these characters are proving that conflicted Draco that we saw hints of in those later films has actually benefited him.
Yeah. Also, he has lovely dark hair now.
Yeah.
And cool glasses.
Yeah. And he was in, and he got to say the damn dirty ape line.
He did. Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
And he delivered it with gusto.
Before I went to see this film, for me there was a slight worry it would be a bit twee.
Yeah.
Very sort of English. That kind of BBC-esque daytime TV kind of feel to it.
I don't know about daytime TV. I feel like that, like maybe like a Sunday night
8 o'clock drama.
Christmas 6 o'clock.
Yeah,
yeah.
And they do a Christmas special. Yeah. And I thought, okay, maybe it's going to be a bit like this, a bit like that, but it really isn't.
No,
it surprised me big time with how real it felt and how interesting the characters were and how invested I was in it.
I think the quality of the story makes such a big difference.
Yeah.
And choosing to, as I said before, get through the romantic storyline quite quickly.
Within
the first sort of 20 minutes, it's set up that they're together.
Yeah, I loved that. Yeah.
And then we talked about pace last week with Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And I think this gets its pace really right because it gets through the romance and then suddenly you're into the political implications of everything they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's a couple against an empire, essentially. Mm.
Yeah, and you'd see other things like this where they're split up and then someone catches his eye when he's away. But the chemistry between them, and because she dedicates that first half hour to really building up that relationship.
Absolutely.
And it feels so real.
You've
got complete hope in them the whole time.
They're such rounded characters, I think. And I think, there's a lovely line where Rosamund Pike's character says, oh, you only married me for my looks. And they laugh about it. But really, clearly there's so much more to their romance than just looks and physical attraction.
Yeah.
And that is crucial for the rest of the film and them staying strong and staying together and staying as a family.
And I really enjoyed that she's never built up to be a big anarchist or anything.
She's not a big fighter of civil rights or anything. She's
not a rebel.
She's just a girl.
Yeah.
Working class girl from East London. Fell in love.
Yeah. And that's, I think her character does develop slightly.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's lovely. They don't overdo that.
Yeah.
They do it a little bit at a time and it feels realistic. Yeah. And, because this film is set over a number of years by the end.
Mm.
So it's interesting that her character is slowly built up into this working class girl that's dropped into this world she has knows nothing about. And that's not just Africa. That's also the political world she's dropped into. She doesn't have a clue about that. Mm.
And it's always nice to see a film of people defying empire, I think, in this day and age.
Yeah.
It's nice to see that these things that still did happen. Any final points to add, gentlemen?
David Oyelowo wearing hats. Mentioned it in the interview, but man, he can wear a hat.
That man can pull off a hat.
Away from his hat, I just wanted to say about his speeches.
Yes.
His speeches in this film are incredible. And I think that's such a talent to do that on film and to give these big speeches and they feel like you're watching him live.
Yeah.
It's amazing. He's such a good... He's so good at vocalising himself and physically feeling like he's there.
I think he's a great orator.
Yes.
And he did that in Selma, but he's also doing it in real life as well, at being the forefront of the black British actor thing. I think he's a really good public speaker, very charismatic, very charming, but not in a manipulative way.
Yeah.
He feels very genuine.
His vocal manipulation is amazing as well. Like, he can, like, you forget his real voice.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
like, when I heard him on the radio recently, I mean, his voice is lovely.
Yeah. It's velvety.
It certainly is. But I'd almost completely forgotten that's what his real voice
he
is.
He did the audiobook for the new James Bond, didn't he?
I bet that's lovely.
Lovely.
If Barbara Broccoli's listening, David Oyelowo.
Yes.
Maybe.
Get down with that.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you listen to his voice. That is a Bondian voice.
I'd just like to give a quick credit to Rosamund Pike as well. She does a very good sort of slightly plummy working class voice.
Without it being comical.
Yeah.
She's not Eliza Doolittle.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's more difficult than we probably give it credit for.
Yeah. Excellent. Also, nice to see Nicholas Lyndhurst again.
Yeah, great, with his tiny little moustache.
I haven't seen him for years.
he hasn't aged a bit.
No, it's one of those films, though, whenever a film, this English production, every now and then you go, oh, it's that guy from The Thing.
Like, there's
quite, but there's quite a few of them just dropped in here, scattered around, like, oh, him.
Yeah, I think he's great because he, I think, is the one that still, sadly, will probably challenge some audience members of what they think.
Yes.
And I think it's too easy to think that because it's set in the 40s, we've moved away from this. I still think there are people that are going to go into this film and have issues with their relationship. And while that's horrible to say, I think Nicholas Lyndhurst's character is the one that they might recognise and relate to, and hopefully they go on the same journey he does. Mm-hmm. Because this film is still so important for changing people's views.
Definitely. Also, my friend James was an extra in this film. So,
hi, James.
That's a little bit of trivia for you.
Well done, James.
Also, I just wanted to say quickly, Tony Benn's in this film, and I think the guy playing him is exceptional. And that character works really nice as sort of being the intermediary between sort of politics and the couple.
Tony Benn biopic, Harry?
He's yeah, we could do that because he's already got a film.
We could do that.
We, like you say, we like me, you, Sam. We'll just get together, make Tony.
I've already got the money together. Our queen of producing.
All right, excellent. So, United Kingdom is released today, but also out today. Just want to make a quick mention to Patterson. That's the new Adam Driver film about bus driver poet. And if you're around in Canterbury or Soho, both of the cousins in those areas are holding poetry slams this evening to celebrate the release of Patterson, so do check those out if you're in the area.
If you are listening to the show today, as in Friday.
If you're listening to this on Sunday, you will need a time machine to go back.
Still going to see it.
Definitely going to see it, but yeah. Okay, and that's it for this week. So if you enjoyed United Kingdom on Cousin Home Cinema at the moment, we have the New Black Film Collective's curated collection. And that includes classics such as Jackie Brown, 12 Years a Slave, and one of the best films of the last few years, in my opinion, Fruitvale Station. Really impressive film by the director of Creed about Oscar Grant III, who was killed absolutely undeservedly by policemen. Really heartbreaking film, but highly recommend that. So that's on Curzon Home Cinema at the moment. And, as usual, a big thank you to CSR for letting us use their shiny studio once again. So that's goodbye from Harry.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Jake.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.